So good morning. We're starting lesson 12 today of our study in Proverbs, and this is the ninth lesson on the My Son, Wisdom and Folly discourses. Today we're going to cover chapter 7. We finished 6 last week, and 6 was the chapter that had the multiple sections on surety and ended in an adultery there. And in chapter 7, we take up the topic of adultery again. So let's read through this passage. My son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commands and live, and my law as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers and write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice, and I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him, with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him. With an impudent face, she said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vows. So I came out to meet you, diligently to seek your face, and I have found you. I have spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him, and he will come home on the appointed day. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Now therefore, listen to me, my children, pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways, do not stray into her paths. For she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. So chapter 6 ended with a strong warning about committing adultery and how adultery will burn you. It demonstrates that you have a lack of instruction, and it will result in severe punishment which cannot be abated. So Solomon continues the topic of adultery, but in a new form. In chapter 7, he uses those colorful images of fire in your bosom and the honey dripping lips. And he instead tells a story and offers very plain instruction. So at the beginning of 7, in verse 1, we find the opening that's been fairly common. We call it the traditional opening for these discourses, my son. He doesn't do it all the time, and he didn't do it throughout all of chapter 6. He only did it a couple of times in 6, I believe. But here we find the traditional introduction to keep my words and treasure my commands within you. So this is repeated in 2, keep my commands, with the added incentive that you will live. And then this phrase comes to keep them and live, and my law as the apple of your eye. So we're supposed to see the parallelism there about keeping the commands and live, and my law as the apple of your eye. So when we're referring to the apple of the eye, obviously the pupil is what he has in mind, and that's the word that's used. But the word also has a broader meaning for dark part. So the dark part of something, or the middle. So you might say the dark part of the night or the middle part of the night. It's important to keep in mind because later on, as he's describing the words and actions of this woman who is luring the simple man, he uses the imagery again of the dark part of the night. So I think if you were hearing this, you would hear, keep my law as the dark part of your eye, as the apple of your eye, and in the night you would hear it again as what's happening. Beware of what's going on with the dark part of the night or the middle of the night. So this idea of the pupil is interesting, and I think Solomon really wants to change the focus the attention of his student here, of his son. So in 7:2, keep my commands and live, and my law is the apple of your eye. Well, this idea comes from Deuteronomy 32, where it's written that really the whole chapter is worth reading. But in verse 10 here, he found him in a desert land and in a wasteland, a howling wilderness. He encircled him. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. So this reference, referring to how God is treating his people, you can see continuing in Psalm 17, keep me as the apple of your eye, hide me under the shadow of your wings, a song that is often sung by children. It's very picturesque, but the idea is that God treasures us, his people, as he does his own pupil as the core of his eye. And we see it in 7:9, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night, in the pupil, as it were. And then in Proverbs 20:20, we find it again, whoever curses his father or his mother, his lamp will be put out in deep darkness, in the very pupil, as it were. So this idea of treasure, I think, as something on your body that you would treasure, is what Solomon's getting at here. It's a core piece of you. I mean, nobody willingly puts their eye in harm's day, in harm's way, right? I mean, people look out and try to protect their eyes, and you know, we have legislation today through OSHA to require safety glasses and such, just to make sure your eye is not going to be hurt. And I think the idea Solomon wants to convey to his son is God has you as the apple of his eye, and he is, as his people, he's encircled them, and he keeps them, and he treasures you. Therefore, treasure God's law, treasure his ways as the apple of your eye, just as God is treasuring you. So there's a use of the words to hearken back to what was said earlier that I think Solomon wants to put in his son's mind. And in verse 3, we have this idea of binding the law on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. So it's another picturesque way of communicating the importance. Now, there's this idea of binding. I don't think it's completely settled what's meant by it. The commentator Zockler has this idea that he thinks it's slightly different from the passage that's very familiar in Deuteronomy 6, where you're to bind God's law on your frontlets and you take God's law with you. He thinks this idea is more ornamental, like you would place a bracelet upon your hand, which corresponds a little bit maybe more closely with what Solomon gave in instruction in the opening of the book of Proverbs in chapter 1, where he talked about them being ornaments and a crown. That may be the idea that he has here in mind. It could refer to Deuteronomy, but the point he's making here in a very picturesque way is that you want the law to be deeply held within you and treasured and stored in a way that will allow you to keep it. And then he adds to this idea. So the first one, the first metaphor is the apple of your eye. The second is this ornamental, putting on the tablet of your heart, thinking that there's a place there for you to record what instruction you need. It's a beautiful image. But then the next image he uses is say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin. Now, I'm not sure. Obviously, it's a metaphor meant to endear tenderness and protection and care, but there may be some additional play involved here between the idea of the strange woman, which he's just been referring to in chapter 6 and he's referred to earlier, and the woman that he's about to discuss in this chapter. So he's saying there are going to be women in your life, and you want to treat God's law as your sister or as your nearest kin, somebody close to you, and not like the women that are potentially going to be found in your life that you need to avoid. So I think in short what he's saying is, don't be a stranger to God's law. In fact, make it something that you treasure, that you hold dear to you. So in verse 6, things change. The style changes of this proverb. So the opening is simple instruction, my son. He's addressing him directly. But then in verse 6, things change. For at the window of my house, well, who's he referring to? Who's the my in this section? This is a story. It's not this clear instruction that we had earlier. I'm not sure who this wisdom is. Is wisdom here the wisdom that's often spoken in the feminine form, lady wisdom, or she goes by different names depending on the commentators and such. So I'm not sure who's being referred to here. But she says what's said is, for at the window of my house, I looked through my lattice. So she's people watching. I'm going to assume that it's a she for the rest of this topic. But she's people watching. And so you guys, I hope, understand that when she says she was looking through the lattice, in homes constructed at that time period, they didn't have screens and things on their window. They would put up lattice to allow air to flow through and yet keep out some of this direct sun so that they could enjoy and try to be a little cooler. So this is somebody who's in her house looking through the lattice. So she's not perfectly visible from the outside, right? You might not be able to see her because she's in the shadows of her lattice here. And she's watching. And what is it that she sees? She sees the youths walking around the city. And she casts her eye deliberately upon one youth in particular. So the class of people that she's focused on are the simple and the young. I perceived among the simple, I perceived among the youths. For this illustration, those are not one and the same, but they don't involve a wide variety of people, right? These are young men who are walking around the city. In particular, she directs her attention to a young man devoid of understanding. It's amazing what this woman can tell, right? As she looks out and says, it's a young man who is devoid of understanding. Passing along the street near, not a corner, but her corner. And he took, what, the path to her house. And so the path here literally means path, right? I mean, he went down that street. But remember, the chief metaphor of Proverbs is way and path is the course of your life. And so I don't think it's a mistake why we use that metaphor, because it really does help understand the way we travel the course of our life. And she's saying, look at the path to her house, which was specifically a path we were told to avoid in the previous chapter. Don't even go near the path of her house. Well, this man, who's characterized, all we know about him is he's devoid of understanding. That's his own simple, and he's a youth, but he's devoid of understanding, and he's already on the wrong path. It also means that he's not out for a walk. This man is passing along her house, yet he takes the path to her house, right? So no one in any kind of honesty is going to say he was out for a walk, right? He might have started out for a walk. We don't know what he was thinking when he left. All we know is what happened when this person saw him looking through the lattice, that he took the path to her house. So at some point, his thoughts, his desires, his urges directed him to go down a street. And this was obvious to the woman looking out at the house. And here Solomon, again, when does this young man do it? In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night, in the pupil of the night. So this young man is not holding God's law as a treasure, nor any of the warnings that God's given him as a treasure. And in fact, he's going into the darkness. Right? That's the imagery. He's walking right in to the darkness. Well, and who does he meet? And there a woman met him. Strangely passive way to word that, isn't it? There a woman met him. Was it a chance meeting? Right? I mean, how'd this take place? Seems uneventful and matter of fact. I don't know why it's worded this way, because that's exactly what didn't happen. It's not that simply, oh, well, they looked, they met. No, he was walking down the path to her house. So in verses 10 through 12, we find out who it is that he's meeting. There's a woman. She has the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. That she's loud and rebellious, and her feet don't like to stay at home. She's outside. She's in the open square. She's lurking at every corner. So, for tonight anyway, she's wearing the attire of a harlot. That, for whatever, I don't know what that looks like, but it's this idea is not new to Proverbs. There are other references with Jacob and his sons. There are others with a harlot could be determined by the way she was dressed. She has a crafty, which means a subtle and a wily and a guarded heart, and guarded in the sense, not in a positive way, but she has a heart that is not revealing all that's in it. That's what we mean by her crafty heart. She's not letting on to all that's in her heart. She doesn't reveal her true plans. She's loud, meaning she has a disquieted mind. She's not settled. She's rebellious, meaning she doesn't have any restraint put upon her. She's apt to go do what she wants to do. She cannot be governed. That's the other idea that we should think about as we find that this woman's rebellious. And she doesn't like to stay at home. And she likes to be where she can be seen. And she likes to lurk. Right? So she goes to the open square. I mean, the idea of being seen and lurking are not necessarily opposites, right? So she can go, she can have a plan in her heart that she's capable of carrying out in alleyways or in the open squares and in the streets, and she can stand on the corner and she can still be lurking, right? She can be hidden in plain sight. And so there's a sense here that she is also on a purposeful trek, right? And the characteristics of this woman are really rather telling. I think in short, what you want to learn from this woman is that she's on the prowl. That's the imagery. This is not a positive image for how we want to act. This is a positive warning about the type of person you want to avoid. This woman is on the prowl. And she wants to ambush somebody. Right? So, the thing to remember is the guy, the young man, the man who is what? What's his chief characteristic that we know of?
Devoid of understanding.
He's devoid of understanding. The young man who is devoid of instruction or correction or understanding, he doesn't know he's about to be ambushed, even though he would like to be ambushed. Right? He would like to find this sexual encounter. It's not going to turn out the way he thinks it's going to turn out. But he's looking for one thing, she's looking for something else. Right? Now, they both have a common intersection that both of them are going to find some things that they want, but they're also, as we get to the rest of the story, are going to find things they didn't want. But this guy, he doesn't see what's happening. We'll see that here in just a few minutes, just how dramatic the surprise is going to come. But the image you should have in mind is that she's on the prowl. And for you young men, you should know there are women like this in the world, right? They want you for the ambush. All right, so in verse 13, what does she do? She catches him and she kisses him. First she caught him, and now she needs to hook him. He's not hooked. Strange as that may seem, he's not hooked yet. But he's taking the bait. But everyone knows who's done any kind of time fishing. A fish can grab some bait and still not be hooked, right? That's where we're at in the process. He's taken the bait. He saw her. He went to her house. She's got the right looks. And she catches him, and the first thing she does is she kisses him. So she's said to have an impudent face, and so she has the strength and the resolve to accomplish everything that she set out to accomplish tonight. And in verse 14, we see where she begins to dissolve his resolve, right? She begins to make whatever resolutions he may have in his mind from the instruction his old man gave him. She wants to make sure that's not an impediment to whatever it is she wants to get done tonight. So the first thing she says is she mentions these peace offerings. And this is all part of the allure. So it has a positive and negative tone to it. She has the peace offerings, meaning I'm a religious person, right? I'm not a pagan. I'm not an outsider. She's still a stranger to him, but I'm not a Gentile. I've made my peace offerings. I paid my vows. So the details of these peace offerings are covered in Leviticus 3 and Leviticus 7, if you want to go back and look at them. And basically, there's food left over from her offerings. We don't know what she vowed. We don't know what the circumstances are, and they're not really important here. But remember, back in chapter 2, we met someone who was said to have forsaken the covenant of her God. That was almost certainly to be an Israelite woman who was wanting to commit adultery. And here, the woman is boasting of her religious duties. So there's a special warning to be careful of those women who profess to be religious and who even go through religious steps. So, I'm not an idolater and I'm not a foreign woman. You can trust me. That's what she's saying here. So in verses 14 through 17, we find that Solomon describes this woman five different times as a woman of thorough preparation. So I've underlined these. I have peace offerings with me. I have paid my vows. I have found you, right? I mean, I've been looking for you. I found you. I've spread my bed with tapestry. I have perfumed my bed, right? So five different times she's relaying to him, I've done this, I've done this, and I've done this. This is all to alleviate his mind so that their night of sexual pleasure can go on unhindered, without any obstacles, and without any threats. So I've done this, I've done that. All the plans are made. We can get this done. So this is all depicted so that this young man will feel safe about what's going to happen, right? I mean, that's the idea. He wants to know that everything's all right and this is going to turn out. And I'm in the dark night. I'm not going to get caught. There's not going to be a problem with any of this. Everything's going to be fine. It's amazing, isn't it? The depths of work people will go through for sin. And if you guys are thinking, well, I don't know, maybe in Solomon's day, but I just can't see that happening today, you're naive. You're not the men who are devoid of instruction. You're naive. There are people who think this way, and they are out there to bring ruin to your life. And you need to be the man of understanding and discernment to know what they look like and what that encounter is going to look like. It's better to not be in the dark night wandering toward her path, looking for the corner that you think she's on. It's better to not even go down that path, right? Because on her path is the way of death, and her steps lead down to hell. It's better to get off that path. But if you're on that path, you should recall Solomon's words, and you should recall my words. I hope Solomon's words haunt you, and I hope my words haunt you. That there are people like this. She has made diligent plans to accomplish the ambush. Okay? All right, I found it interesting. This is really an aside, but in verse 16, I think that idea of linen could be translated cotton as well. But isn't Egyptian cotton, I mean, I know 20 or 30 years ago, Egyptian cotton was still considered world-class quality of cotton. I don't know if it's still held in that same regard, but talk about comparative advantage. I mean, here we are 3,000 years later, and these people still own the market on cotton. I found that fascinating, Egyptian cottons. So, all right.
I'm sure it wasn't really supposed to interpret the Egyptian high threat count.
Yeah, that's right. The modern translations probably say that. So as we look through verse 18, we've found all these preparations. Now, you might think, well, I don't necessarily, I'm not excited about a bed with tapestry. I'm not excited about cinnamon and aloes and such. This was written by someone in 1000 BC. It shows the antiquity of it. This is what they were thinking. We can certainly translate it and update it for ourselves. And then in verse 18, she's made all these preparations. She's declared these preparations to him. And now she's saying, this is going to be a lot of fun. That's what she's done. I've taken care of all the details. Don't worry about it. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. So this idea of take our fill means to be completely satiated. It's not the same word that was used for intoxicated with delight in previous chapters back in 5. But instead she's saying, let's have a whole night of physical pleasure. That's what, I've made all these preparations, and it's just you and I. Let's have a night of physical pleasure. Physical delight is all that's before her mind right now. That's what she wants. And in verse 19 and 20, I think we should look at this as sort of the story moving in stages. So the woman meets him. It's clear who she is. He's without excuse. And she catches him and kisses him, and the allure begins, right? So then she's made all these plans, and then she says, think about what this is going to be like. We're going to be together all night long. This is going to be an unmitigated night of sexual pleasure. And you can tell just in his mind what he's thinking. This is really cool. She's taking care of everything. She's got all this covered. This is going to be a great night. And then something in the back of his mind says, well, what about the husband? Are you married, by the way? Whether he thought to ask it or whether he was just thinking it, she's clever enough to immediately turn to the next stage. My husband's not at home. In fact, he's gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him, and he'll come home on the appointed day. And the time reference inside here is, he's not going to be back tomorrow. He's not going to be back next week. Weeks and months from now is when this guy's going to be back. There's no chance that he's going to get done early and be here. That's the idea. It's far enough in the future, you don't have to worry about this. So the two of them are contented that they've solved all the problems. So let's just step back for a second. Let's look at the stage of the allure. So she's looking for him. He's looking for her. That's what we know, right? He may not have looked for her specifically, but probably. She catches and kisses him. She demonstrates religious commitment. She describes how beautiful and adorned her place is. This is what's to look forward to. She described what she wants from him, how great the sex is going to be. And then she finally persuades him to overcome his hesitation through assurances that the husband is not at home and will not be home for quite some time. So when we look at this, no, that's not it. Did I miss those verses? With her enticing speech in verse 21, she caused him to yield, and with her flattering lips, she seduced him. So, lips are used multiple times here. Her enticing speech, the words of her mouth, her flattering lips. She caught him and kissed him earlier, so she says these things earlier. It's all over at this point. With her speech, she caused him to yield. The commentator Bridges makes this remark upon this passage that this man, unarmed with principle, the weakness of resolution yields to the seduction of lust, and her unsuspecting prey rushes on to ruin. I think this is an important point to keep in mind. The man is unarmed with principle, right? He seems to have, all he has is some resolution. I don't want to get in trouble, but he's not being guided by instruction. If he'd been guided by instruction, he might have still had all these lustful thoughts and inclinations, but he wouldn't have been on the path, would he? So all that's left is perhaps a resolution in his mind that I'm not going to give in to anything terribly wicked. For whatever, however irrational that might seem, that's the nature of sin, and that's probably how he's thinking, that I'm not going to do anything bad. And he progresses down this, and she's caught him, and she's reeling him in. It's over at this point. With this enticing speech, it's over. She has seduced him. So the two of them seem to be principally concerned about being caught by the husband. And that would relate back to what we discovered in Proverbs 6 about how the anger of the husband is not something that can be abated. It can't be ameliorated in any way, right? You can't buy him off with many gifts. When it comes, it's over. And so when you get to the end here, in verse 22, Solomon brings this to a close of the progress of his fall and brings it right to this precipice. Immediately he went after her, right? She caused him to yield. She seduced him. And what did he do? Wow. We went right after her. How? As an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver. And as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know what cost his life. So in these two verses here are some hard to translate phrases. Some of the imagery isn't apparent right at face value. So I want to spend a little time thinking about how to approach this here. So we've got in verses 22 and 23, we've got an ox, we've got stocks, we've got liver, and we've got birds, right? So somehow we draw the lesson from this. So the young man who is devoid of understanding is depicted as an ox being led to the slaughter. So, an ox doesn't mind going to the slaughter, does he? Might even be the allure of some food or something, right? I mean, it's not as if the owner of the ox comes and says, "Make your peace, beast. It's over in a few minutes," right? Right? Not like in the classic westerns right before the shootout, you know, "Have you made your peace? Give me a minute," right? No, he's an ox. You just lead him straight on to the slaughter. He's, at this point, a dumb beast. That's what this man has been reduced to. He's also, in Proverbs 6, been told he's reduced to a crust of bread, right? Tap, tap, tap. He's just a hardened crust. He's useless. He's devoid of understanding. Obviously, she's leading him to slaughter, but he doesn't see it. He doesn't even know he's going. The bedroom is the slaughterhouse. And he doesn't know it. He doesn't see it. So then we find the idea of the stocks. And I'm sure the idea of the putting someone in stocks or in fetters or being pilloried, let's equate those for the moment, is of recent enough vintage that people can remember. They've seen pictures and, you know, colonial city this or colonial city that, or reenactments. There might be somebody who's in the stocks. Bunyan uses the idea of being pilloried. And so I don't think it's a hard idea to understand here, but I think what's in mind is maybe a little different than just somebody who's been placed in a restraint. The word for stocks and fetters is only used in one other place. That's Isaiah 3:18, and it says here that in that day the Lord will take away the finery, the jingling anklets, the scarves, and the crescents. So that's not the idea of the stocks as we've come to know it. And I want to read this quote from commentator Delitzsch because I think it helps to shed some light on why it's important to see what's being taught here. So he writes, "He follows her as a fool to the correction or the restraint with fetters, or if to be understood not so much physically as morally, and refers to the self-destroying conduct as a madman or as a criminal to chains. The one figure denotes the fate into which he rushes like a beast devoid of reason, as the loss of life. And the other denotes the fate to which he permits himself to be led by that fair woman, like a criminal by the police officer, as the loss of freedom and of honor." So that was the other image in Proverbs 6 that was conveyed to us, that there's no honor among this man who's committed. Remember, even thieves, when they're caught stealing, are still treated with some amount of dignity because they stole because they were hungry. But to the man who committed adultery, nobody takes pity on a thief. So in both cases, that of the ox and that of the stocks, we find someone being led somewhere with strong descriptions of their state of mind, right? He's devoid of reason, or he's being hauled off because of his immoral behavior. Now this idea in verse 23, till an arrow struck his liver, is an odd image. How does it fit? And it's not so clear. Some people have tried to reorder the wording so that maybe the arrow being struck in the liver is what happens to the bird after it's snared, that sort of thing. But there's no real textual evidence that's the case. It could be just, it's hard to understand. But here's one possible explanation, in that the man is being led into the stocks until he can be shot with an arrow in his liver. And it's important at least to understand, not to just imagine that he's being hauled off so he can be shot. That's not the main picture. But the idea of the liver is important. The ancients held various ideas about internal organs, and the liver was a very important internal organ. So there's Exodus and Leviticus discuss what to do with the liver and the sacrificial system and how it should be used. Lamentations 2:11 uses it. Ezekiel 21:21 uses it. I don't know if the CY remember on one of the retreats out at the lake we were discussing Nebuchadnezzar. Remember, he was approaching a fork in the road, couldn't decide to go to Jerusalem or I can't remember the other city. Damascus, I think, what to conquer next, and he got to this fork in the road. So what did he do? He divided the liver. Remember, we passed around the liver to see if we could determine whether we should go left or right. Here's the world's greatest power, and what's he doing? He's looking at a liver to find it. So the ancients held some serious importance to the idea of a liver. But one of the ideas behind that of the liver, and I think is probably being communicated here, is that the liver is the seat of passion and emotion. The young man is suddenly becoming aware of what's happened. He got caught, he's aware of it, and he's howling in regret. That also is an image we picked at earlier, of the man who was devoid of understanding. When he exclaims at being caught by his various snares, says, "Oh, how I have hated instruction." Right, that was one of the cries he made in an earlier scenario. And I think maybe that same idea is here, is you think you're getting away with this, but you're going to be struck in your liver. So commentator Delitz, again, has some helpful insight here. Looking at some ancient ways of thinking of the liver, he says, "He who is lovesick has jacur ulcerosum," the Latin phrase. He is diseased in his liver. So everybody remember what Caleb looked like before he got married? That's liver disease. That's what liver disease looks like. He was love struck. Liver disease. But the arrow here is not the arrow of love, which makes people lovesick, but the arrow of death, which slays him who is ensnared in sinful love. The befooled, I like that word, befooled youth continues the disreputable relation into which he has entered till it terminates in adultery and in lingering disease upon his body, remorse in his soul and dishonor to his name, speedily ending in inevitable ruin both spiritually and temporarily. Some commentators have even thought that this is a reference to sexually transmitted diseases, that this guy is, I don't know that we want to go so far, but it's not unimaginable to think that he's meeting this harlot and he is overcome with an STD, or certainly with the pangs of regret because of the passions in his body. The Message Bible summarizes this section by saying, "Soon she has him eating out of her hand, bewitched by her honeyed speech. Before you know it, he's trotting behind her like a calf led to the butcher shop, like a stag lured in ambush and then shot with an arrow, like a bird flying into a net not knowing that its flying life is over." It's not a bad way to paraphrase that section. And then we find at the end here, this bird hastening to the snare. I think it's a continuation of one of the earliest, in Proverbs 1:17, one of the earliest metaphors that Solomon uses about the young man who's devoid of understanding, and it's the father trying to instruct him, look for the net, don't look for the bait. Remember that? That's the catchphrase from there. And I think here we find this metaphor saying, he didn't look for the net. He only was looking at the bait. In fact, the bait came and kissed him and told him everything's taken care of, so it's over with. And then finally, in these last four verses, we have these four distichs or paired couplets, which I think are an interesting way that Solomon is helping his son remember these things. So, listen to me, my children, pay attention to the words of my mouth, urging his son to listen in 25 here, ways and paths. The warning here is you must keep your heart, remember that from Proverbs 4, keep your heart with what? All diligence. Do not decline or turn aside to her way. The warning is repeated with another firm instruction not to stray or wander. There's no sightseeing here. Don't go out looking and see what's available and then decide you're not going to do it. In verse 26, you're not strong enough. So he's anticipating his son saying, I can handle this. I got it, Dad. No, the people that she has slayed were strong men. They were stronger than you are. Look what happened to them. Learn from them. Look what happened and learn. And then in 27, we find hell and death. Proverbs 5:5 tells us that this woman, her feet, where do they go? Down to hell. They go down to death. Her feet, her steps lay hold of hell. So here we have the latitude and the longitude of hell's entrance. It's her house. There are only steps which separate you from judgment. That's how Solomon ends this. They're just mere steps. Once you decide to take a stroll that night, it's effectively over for you. Because you're on her territory, and she's going to win, you're going to die. And if you live, you're going to be nothing more than that dumb ox or that fool that was cast into the stocks. It's going to be a hard life. A lot of imagery in there. That was a long monologue, but I'll take any questions or comments you have.
I had a couple things about stocks. I was wondering, it's not a biblically prescribed form of punishment, but there are a few instances in Scripture where it refers to, like Asa threw the seer, put the seer in stocks. So it seems to have been in use at least occasionally. But I was also wondering about the liver and this. And I have a different interpretation here.
People were over the map, all over the map here, and I think it's hard, so we're open for alternate ideas.
I know that I checked scriptures for liver, and it appears mainly in the prophetic passages, and then one time when the king divides the liver and so on is part of his thing. But both liver, liver shot with a bow and a snare, neither one are quick to death.
Yeah.
If you want to shoot a deer and kill it and recover it, shoot it in the heart and lungs. Right? If you shoot it farther back, kidneys, liver, those all be fatal shots, but they're not. The deer's going to keep going and die a lingering death, probably. Snare. Actually, people don't put snares and then sit and watch for the bird fall into the snare and then go club it. Put out a snare, come back, check it in the morning, or that, you know, once or twice a day. Stocks, you know, they all are images of sort of what lingering in prison, but trapped before you die. So
that's great. Yeah, I really like that. That's.
Anytime you can bring
Bo on. That's right. I will say, just anecdotally, whenever we would read this passage at mealtime, I would make sure one of the boys were sitting next to me. Normally I want them far away, bring the girls up close. But I'd make sure the boys were near me. And when we got to this part, we struck through the liver. I used to reach behind their chair where they couldn't see it. And I'd poke them hard right in the liver when I got to that so they'd howl. Said, now there's a living proverb for you right there. Pay attention. There are just certain advantages to being a dad that are great. I love it. Yeah. There's a question back there. Yes.
She needs him. She's lonely. She wants him, at least. And he thinks he, in a small part of him, may think he's being
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's true. Yeah, that's right.
I think a good contrast to this is how Joseph responded to Potiphar's wife.
That's right.
I think we talked about that, but you know, I think the verses, the last three verses, 25, 26, 27, kind of tell the foolish young man what he should have done. And I think we see that's how Joseph reacted.
That's an excellent reminder. Joseph is an excellent, excellent reminder there. That's right. And he suffered for it, didn't he? He really did, but he kept his honor. Yeah.
I probably shouldn't even say anything because I really haven't organized my thought here, but I don't really know how to compare or to. You have this, it's all, the man goes down her path, like you said, he's on her street. It's no accident. So we know that from the rest of Proverbs as well, the heart is the ultimate issue here. It's devoid of understanding. His heart is really bent on sin. There's no accident here. But I was also trying to compare that to today. You know, back then, it's not like he had trouble finding her place. It was accidentally there and so on. It was plenty easy back then. Now, with the internet and the massive problem of pornography inside the church, and now I don't know how to. I'm trying to compare the metaphor now and say, well, I don't even know how to do it. Her path is through every room in his house now, and she's in every room in his house, and she's in the street, and she's on that street. I don't even know. Like I said, it really seems like a bad thing. I don't know how to even compare it to this. So if the heart is at all inclined that way, you don't even have to go a block over. She's already in your living room. She's in your pocket.
It's not even the deep, dark night.
Right.
Yeah, it's ways, paths, and URLs.
Yeah,
that's right.
Maybe that explains why it's just epidemic. I mean, it's beyond epidemic.
Yep. All right, well, let's...